Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And I predict with this show, we'll get an extra shot of laughter because my guest is Dr. Bob Basso. Hello, Dr. Bob.
Hello, hello, Dr. D. I got to tell you right off the bat, I'm aroused and excited, but not for the reason you think. You are conducting this interview with me at the other end, and I am in my physical therapist's office. I just finished my workout, 45 minutes, my back cracked, my buttocks stretched, my spine in traction.
Yeah.
And as we speak, I have a heat pad on my butt and a heat pad across my lower abdominals. What better position to be in to talk to a sex therapist?
I agree. I absolutely agree. You're hot, Bob.
I'm not so hot, but my rear end is right now.
Well, okay. you were on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and I would like to quote to our listening audience what Oprah said when she introduced you, because she's often right on. And she said, if life is a three-ring circus, my next guest would need four more rings. Actor, writer, author, award-winning TV newsman, in-demand speaker, business consultant to corporate America, and creator of laughter therapy. And that, of course, brings hope to lots of hospital patients all over the country. And then People Magazine called Dr. Bob America's number one fun, motivating speaker.
And my mother called me Hey You.
Hey You.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Put out the garbage.
And
my
dear
mother, who once introduced me to an audience, and she was told to make it very short and to the point. It was an audience of the American Funeral Directors Association, and they kept hounding her, make this introduction short. And there are a lot of sour pusses in that audience. She got to the microphone, she spoke seven words, and had half of the sour pusses wondering what was going on, and the other half on the floor. And the seven words were, he was better as a coming attraction. Oprah was kinder.
Well, you know,
my Brooklyn mama.
Yeah, your Brooklyn mama, and you and I go back. We have a history, Bob, don't we?
Yes, let's see. It was Sing Sing, 2 to 4 years. You were in the cell down the hall. There was that. There was the strip club where you were doing strip therapy. Should I be talking about this as we go around the world?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. But anyway, I knew you from my first time in Hawaii in the late 60s, and we met at a gridiron show on Kauai. What a good memory I have. And what were you doing? You were performing in that gridiron show, and you were very adorable. Do you remember that?
I used to be adorable. Now I'm Presbyterian. I changed.
Okay.
What was I doing? I have no idea. Probably waiting tables.
No, you were in the
show.
You
tell people what a gridiron show is, though.
Gridiron. It's for the press. It's
a laughter therapy show for uptight newsmen. Where they get together and they have to tell jokes and they have to lighten up and make fun of the world at large. So.
And you're perfect for that. And you've developed it. And then I was very pleased to have you on my radio show when I lived in Hawaii. And I remember you're talking about your mother. I mean, your mother really had a great sense of humor. Tell a little story before we get into the meat of this program about your mother visiting the television set when you were a newsman.
I was doing the sports. We were a number third rated show station in a three station market.
Yeah,
and
that's right. The old days.
They hired me and they wanted me to be another Howard Cosell. Come on, yelling and screaming and doing crazy, outrageous things.
Mm-hmm.
So one day I looked in the camera, and Hawaii is a big, big repository of gamblers. They love to gamble. They love to gamble on sports. As a matter of a clear blue sky, I said, my Brooklyn mama is going to give you the winners and losers of the NFL games this Sunday. And I proceeded to say things like the Rams 32, Cleveland 31, and on and on. And I said, and my mother should be listened to. She's a Brooklyn bookie. My poor mother was far from a Brooklyn bookie, but she heard it. She heard it on the air.
Uh-huh.
And she came into the studio the next day with a big tray in the middle of us talking about the rapes, robberies, and revolutions, which was what we're still talking about on the newscast.
Yeah.
And she had a tray of chicken soup. And she said, both you and this guy was at that time the news anchor, which I later became. She says, you need some hot chicken soup to straighten up your brains. And she became a cause célèbre. And while she was there, here's the end of the story, and it made headlines around America and the world. I said to my mother, while you're here, Mom, why don't you predict who's going to win the 1969 World Series? They haven't even picked the teams yet. It was the beginning of the season. She didn't hesitate. She says, what camera do you want me to look in? I says, that one right there. She says, Hawaii, put all your money on the New York Mets. They're going to win. The Mets had lost 98 games the year before and were picked by the Vegas odds maker as coming in last. Well, you know what happened. They won the National League Championship, and they won the World Series. My mother was hounded by newsmen all over Hawaii and the world. What does this woman know? She says, I just looked at the uniforms and said, that's a better uniform, and made up a score. That was my mama, and she was just part of my story and part of the 11 books I've been fortunate enough to write about how fun and humor has impacted my life and the things I do, particularly with the medical profession and particularly with cancer wards around the world. That's
yes,
my Brooklyn mama.
Talk about that, because you really, I think it was 1973, maybe, if I have...
How is this possible? I just reached my 32nd birthday
for
the third time, but nevertheless, boy, you're making me feel old.
I think in 1973, thereabouts, you actually created laughter therapy, and you were the perfect person to do this, really perfect. And let's talk a little bit about laughter therapy in the cancer wards, and because you've had a lot of experience with this, and a little bit about laughter and health.
Well, I was very fortunate in the 7 to 8 different careers I had to meet a very special man who wrote a very special book that became a number one bestseller for 2 years on the New York Times bestseller list. And I recommend any human being who has any kind of a problem, whether it's medical or not, to read it. It was called An Anatomy of an Illness by Norman Cousins. Norman Cousins was a terrific, positive fellow, the editor of the Saturday Review of Literature. He went into his doctor one day, said he had a pain in his back. The doctor looked at it and said, you'll be dead in 2.5 months. You have something we cannot cure. They put him in a hospital. He looked around, and I think many of the people listening to this conversation can identify with it. He looked around. He said, a hospital is no place for a sick person to be.
Right.
It's very antiseptic. White people are talking language, oxycodone and MRIs, language that is intimidating. And the people that come in here have sour pusses. He postulated something then that I was working on, and we hooked up, and of course it's since become a cause celebrate not only in the medical profession but around the world. He postulated something simply that no one else had thought of before. He read that when we are negative, when we're yelling and screaming or giving someone the finger on the highway, the body actually secretes 2,000 different secretions that exacerbate, that make the situation worse, that makes us want to be more angry. And he said, well, what happens when you're happy and you're positive? Well, he did some research, as he always did, and he realized there's a thing called endorphins in the human body. And basically, they're Mother Nature's natural painkillers. And he says, well, if I'm going to be happy and positive in a response to this cancer, it's going to have some effect on my back. He had his wife come in, repaint the room in the hospital, fire both the doctors who were working with him because he said you were too negative. I want all positive responses, and I want positive people around me. She brought in balloons and clowns and over 200 Laurel and Hardy and various sitcoms that were very popular at the time. And he would sit in that room and laugh. I know this sounds kind of syrupy, and no, he's not going to tell us that the guy overcame it. Yes, he did. Within 6 weeks, they were all mystified that this supposed disease in his back was retreating, and they had no explanation for it. He did. And, of course, eventually he became very healthy within a year, and that 2 months that he was supposed to die passed, and he lived for 17 more years, and him and I had the good fortune to go into cancer wards. And when we went into cancer wards, we'd go into the children's cancer ward first. Now, anybody who's ever been in the hospital, you know when you go to the children's ward, what's the first thing that happens when you walk through the door? What do you see? You've done it, Dr. D. What do you see in the children's cancer ward?
Well,
you see balloons. You see teddy bears.
Yeah.
You see happy people. And you see the nurses wearing everything but antiseptic white uniform.
Exactly.
They have clowns on it. They have all kinds of funny goodies. Well, we did some research and found out in three of these cancer wards, a total of 24% of the children who were supposed to die within 6 months did not die. And one of the contributing factors, I'm not saying because there was balloons and there were clowns, they miraculously heal, but it set the stage for their parents and their doctors that these children are to stay in a state of fun and humor. Why? Because fun and humor cuts down all the monsters that we face. And the biggest single problem we have with American education, as far as I'm concerned, we teach people that if you face a tragedy, your response has to be tragic. And they don't understand there's an alternate response, and that alternate response is positive. Now, what that positive response is, that's the series of a whole nother book, and it's all about people taking charge. And the premise is you may have cancer, but the cancer doesn't have you, pal. So here's what you have to do. And later on, if you have some moments, I'll tell you about some dramatic things that happened. When I went to the cancer clinic in Houston, Texas, many years ago, and people were hooked up by telemetry, and I was behind one of these one-way mirrors, I guess two-way mirrors, one-way for the patient. They didn't know I was there. And we were watching patients at the time that they were told they had cancer. And the scene went like this. The patient comes in scared, stiff, knowing it's going to be dreadful news. And the doctor comes in and says, hello, I'm Dr. Basso, and you have colorectal cancer. You have about 2 to 2.5 months to live. Oh, my God, the yelling and screaming. And the telemetry, and I'm in the room watching how this person's body is reacting. Everything went off the chart. The blood pressure went beyond high, and they could not sedate these people. We got a hold of the doctors. Now, this is 30 years ago, and we suggested another way to give that news, because it is bad news, and does bad news have to be delivered in a negative way, and is that negative way going to exacerbate that person's cancer? So the next day, with this doctor being trained, in comes another patient, sits down. Doctor says, how you doing? I'm Dr. Basso. Shakes his hand. He says, how you feeling? So, some days good, some days bad. He says, yeah. He says, you think you got problems? He says, well, if I told you what my wife said to me this morning, and on starts telling a joke. And he looks at the guy, and we're looking at the telemetry. The more they talked, not about the cancer, about fun things, and just two guys talking, his vital signs were normal. Then he looks at him and he says, my friend, you've got something we cure 44% of the time. Are you willing to work with us? Because they did not use any kind of medication. All the intervention was about dealing with the mind's response to this cancer. You've got something we cure 44% of the time. Are you willing to work with us? Are you willing to get rid of every negative influence in your life, even if it means your wife and your kids? And sometimes that was the case. And the guy looked at him. He says, yeah. He says, because you're in charge. He says, and we're going to work together. Do you agree? He says, yes. He says, you have a little colorectal cancer. A little colorectal cancer. But do you see the difference? The telemetry on that patient who was told in a positive way, and the positive aspect, 44% of the time we cure it here, and you can be one of them, but you have to work with us. Those kinds of responses. Now, years ago, you'd have the medical profession saying, oh, it's all anecdotal. Everyone likes to laugh. Everyone likes to feel good. Yeah, but does it really have any function in the body? Does the body heal itself because it's laughing? You bet it does, and has a better, and it's been proven now in the last 30 years. There's all kinds of books been written about it, including one of mine. That there
I know.
Is absolute proof that when people face a negative situation in a positive way, they have a better opportunity to control it. I'm going to ask you a question.
Yeah.
And at the same time I ask you, Dr. D,
yeah,
I'm asking everybody who may be listening to this question. What four-year period in American history did we as a nation produce more positive literature, more positive movies, more positive comedy shows on the radio than at any time before in the history of this country? When was it? What four-year period?
Well, I'm going to guess World War II.
You bet. 1940 to 1945, when the world was facing its biggest, most hideous evil cancer, we were in danger of losing not only America, but the world. Most people don't realize when the bombs fell on Pearl Harbor, we had the 19th standing army in the world behind Cuba and Brazil. We only had 240,000 men and women in uniform.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me why they were singing Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree, the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. You gotta live positively, you gotta think positive. Why were they singing? Why did pilots in World War II that were asked to sit inside a flying coffin called a B-17, the Flying Fortress? It was called a flying coffin. What's the first thing those pilots did? And this is all a metaphor about our lives, because in America, we are taught and conditioned to be serious, sanctimonious, and uptight when facing any kind of a problem. And that's the worst physical condition you can be in to heal yourself. Now, back to the pilots. What? Now, I know you're much too young. You were born years and years after World War I. But you've seen movies, you've seen John Wayne movies, we've seen World War II movies during that period. What was the first thing those pilots did to those flying coffins? They got a can of paint, and they got a paintbrush, and they painted the nose of the plane and called it the Fabulous Legs. And there's Betty Grable. The Memphis Belle. They gave that flying coffin, and see it as a metaphor for cancer, for all the problems you have, for everything that's going on in America today. We're going over the fiscal cliff, all these scare words. We're on the brink. We got credit downgrade, and the biggest scare word of all, Joe Biden. What did these pilots do? They changed the perception of that plane. That plane became their gal. It was Betty Grable. It was the Memphis Belle. They were in charge. And that plane, which was a flying coffin, was going to bring them back safely. Well, of course, as we know, many of them did not come back. 10,000 were lost in the first 2 years alone. But those that came back, years later, when they gave their testimony, and I had the wonderful opportunity to interview these men, they said these planes were like a mother and are sisters to us, and we had faith in those planes. And the guy who was talking to me said, when we finally landed with our pilot shot dead and two of the men in very serious condition, they counted 378 bullet holes in that plane. But we knew the old girl would bring us home. Why aren't we as a nation, why aren't we looking at all the problems we had, not laughing, ha, 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 is, oh, whoa, we're going over the financial cliff, ha, ha, ha. No, I'm not suggesting that kind of frivolous laughter. I'm suggesting the first question you ask, what is the positive response? And unfortunately, young people today, everything that stimulates them, including what they call rap music. I was talking about rap music to a group yesterday, and a lady about 82 years of age stood up and she said, music. She said, I've heard large animals passing gas that was more rhythmic than that crud. And you could hear 1,000 people standing and cheering. I'm not putting down young people, but what we allow to stimulate us is what we become. And take a look at what young people are allowing to stimulate them.
Well,
one of them, I'm sure, is Dr. Diane.
you have so much wisdom and your approach.
Tell my mother, please tell
yes,
my mother I have
your
wisdom.
Sweet dear mother, what you say makes a lot of sense, and I just wanted to add that I just wanted to put in here a little bit of the physiological part that goes on, because a good laugh, like a good cry or good sex, we're going to talk about sex and fun and play, and probably after the break in this program.
Do you have any pictures to show me?
No, I don't,
okay,
because this is
right.
Radio. We'll have to use our imagination. So, but okay. It's a natural tranquilizer, because as I understand it, there's a slight raise in the heart rate and blood pressure during a laugh, and then the body muscles almost immediately relax and blood pressure drops. And at the same time, the brain may release endorphins. I think that's true. It does. And so laughing becomes a natural stress buster.
You ain't kidding. You are probably very well aware of it, and I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of all these little tips that come across the internet. If you're having a stroke, do this. If you're having a heart attack, do this. The latest tip that's been approved by UCLA Neurological Research Center, if you think you're having a heart attack, laugh as hard as you possibly can. Get that belly rolling,
yeah,
and get that laugh working, because A, it does relax the muscles, and you've
mm-hmm.
got to relax that attacking heart. So a laugh, as you very cogently observed, I don't know what that word means, but I used it once in a crossword puzzle, and it sounded good. I
it
think
sounds
it has something
good.
To do with religion.
Observed,
I'm not
yeah.
sure. Yeah, I went to the Church of Cogency yesterday. Anyway, laughter has a physiological effect. Now, one of the things we do, and we demonstrate this, is always doubting Thomas's. And I was speaking about 3 months ago to a
yeah.
medical group, 3,000 people in Arkansas. The gal stands up. She says, you know, I'm sick and tired of hearing phony balonies like you talk about stress. Phony balonies like me. Why am I a phony baloney? And you sound like my mother. She said, I have cancer, and you're telling me I can laugh my way to health. I'm telling you that laughter and changing your perception of pain, which is what laughter does.
Right.
The therapeutic use of laughter is changing your perception of pain. And once you change that perception, you have a better opportunity physiologically, but more importantly, mentally, to take charge of this monster that's attacking you.
Yeah, actually, when you're laughing, it's like internal jogging. And mm-hmm. I know about one study, there have been many, where they took the blood of groups and then watched a funny video, and then they took the blood 10 minutes later, and then another 10 minutes later, and then at the end. And it turns out that laughter absolutely affected the chemicals cortisol, and which is the primary stress hormone, most significantly. So a lot of doctors use laughter therapy, the smart doctors, and I'm sure you've influenced a lot of them, as an adjunct to medical therapy. And it's like, especially what you talked about, the heart, it's a form of internal jogging. It's such a nice way to get the lungs to move and the blood to circulate.
You're absolutely right, my dear. A laugh changes the body chemically. And we have learned over the last 30 years at UCLA Medical Research, the research that Norman Cousins and I did, that the chemical reaction when you're laughing, when you're in a state of euphoria, and I know you're going to talk about a very special state of euphoria in a few minutes. Incidentally, I love the title of your show, Love, Lust, and Laughter. When I heard that title, I thought, gee, it sounded like a novel about what happens in the U.S. Congress. But it's such a great, great title because you are connecting. You're connecting love, lust, and then with laughter. No one else has done it. That's like saying I'll have a ham and cheese on a Kahlua pig at a luau. You know, they don't seem to go together, but they can.
Yes, well, Bob, we are going to, at half past the hour, which is about 4 minutes from now, we're going to take a little break. And then when we come back from the break, I'm just letting the audience know, because we're going to talk about what part fun plays in sex and what part does fun play in your sex life, Bob, in my sex life, Dr. Diana. We're going to ask the listening audience to think about what part they're starting it early, I guess, because I talked about it. That's all right. We'll start the break early. And then so people just hang on, because we'll come back and talk about fun and sex and laughter. Stay with us. Happy feet, da da da, happy feet, da da da, happy feet. Oh, I love it,
love it. Happy feet, da da da, happy feet, da da da, happy feet.
We're back. Oh, Dr. Bob Basso, it's just such a pleasure to have you on this program. And we're going to start to talk about sex and play. And I want to make an announcement that after 30 years of seeing thousands of couples, this is what I know for sure, Dr. Bob. Couples who laugh together, and a shared sense of humor. It seems to allow the person and his or her partner to understand their common values, their needs, their interests, their levels of intelligence, and these are all keys to relationship longevity. And I was surprised, I didn't know this when I first started marital counseling or couples counseling, that couples can learn to put playfulness into their relationships. Isn't that interesting?
Tell me the first thing they should do to put playfulness into their relationship.
Well, the first thing they should do...
Tear up their credit cards? What?
No, they should play. Sex is play. They should relax. They should laugh. You know, a lot of people think, especially guys, they get it, and especially guys with premature ejaculation, I have a job to do here, and there's, a ton of performance anxiety. And ideally, sex should be play. It doesn't have a beginning, a middle, and an end. I think there really is, and I know you're going to agree with this, there's
I'm under pressure now. I have to agree with you. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, not necessarily, but there is an essential need for silliness in life, because there's a 3-year-old inside each one of us, and we're not talking about the wounded inner child either. You know, the happy, giggling 3-year-old. And actually, sometimes I find my couples have to put the critical parent to sleep so that that happy, giggling 3-year-old can come out to play, especially with sex play.
Well, one day, a student of Plato, you remember him, that old Greek guy a couple of thousand years ago who had some pretty sharp observations on life, was asked by a student, "Master, how should I live my life?" And Plato, who's considered by so many people, wrongfully, was this very serious, contemplative man who sat on a hill contemplating his navel and coming up with these incredibly complex observations of life. Not at all. He looked at him and he said, "Young man, life must be lived as if it were play." And that's from Plato. Why did he say it? He went on in some other writings to explain. When you play, you are free to create. When you play, you reach and you expose yourself to things you never thought you could do. Because when you play, everything is possible. Michael Jordan once said, and I interviewed him twice, spent 2 days with him, once said, "When I became totally confident in what I did on the court," he said, "I decided I was going to do dunking the ball that no one else had ever done." He says, "When I began to do that, I had no idea what this thing was going to end up with." And of course, we've all seen that wonderful picture of him dribbling down the court and at the head of the key, all right, 15, 18 feet from the basket. He jumps and he glides through the air and he does the Jordan dunk. Then he did the hammer dunk and the tomahawk dunk. He didn't know what he was going to do. What he said was, "I gave myself permission to play the game like I played it as a kid." And he said, "It opened up a whole new world to me." So the greatest thing about play is that you can access things inside of you. You can create plays. You can create poetry. Bad, good, or indifferent, it doesn't matter. But you have to access it first. And the world is telling us you have to do it our way. The Republicans are saying you have to do it our way. The Democrats are saying you have to do it our way. And they're both wrong. According to the American polls, 3 out of 4 Americans think that both parties have failed them, that both parties are involved in their ego and not the common good. I'm not speaking politically. I'm talking now as to the attitude in our country. Why are we so uptight? Well, our political system and how they speak to one another is one of the reasons. But Michael Jordan said it all. Once you give yourself permission to play, you become creative. Now, the next question, I'm sure, being mentally telepathic, I can tell you're going to say, "Well, yeah, but you've done a lot of work with corporate America. You're going to go in and tell Steve Jobs? You're going to go in and tell William Bennett, the richest man in Las Vegas, how to run 21 casinos and make it fun?" You bet, and I have, and it's in one of the books, Confessions of an American Speaker. And the subtitle is the words that my father spoke to me 47 seconds before he died. When I looked at him, I said, "Daddy, how do you really feel about me?" And he was shaking 200,000 times from Parkinson's disease. He had colorectal cancer attacking not only his lower regions, but all through his body. With the last gasp of his life, he looked at me and he said, and I'll clean this up, "If bullcrap was concrete, you'd be Route 66. And he had a big smile on his face. My daddy, the fire chief from New York, was teaching me my final lesson. Lighten up. We all die. Stop this sanctimony. I love the laughter." And I'll talk about how we brought my dad back using fun and laughter. He was telling me that it's not that important. And just to understand that you've got to enjoy every moment of life. He wasn't putting me down, although I am a BS artist, according to my critics. I accept that. But I remember what my daddy said. And he said that 47 seconds before he died. It was a great lesson, and it validated, in my mind, everything I grew up with, because we grew up in a family where we weren't Ozzy and Harriet, Mom and Dad. They were more like the Honeymooners, Ralph and...
Yeah.
One of these days, Alice, one of these days.
One of these days.
Oh, right to the moon. But my father required us, regardless of how we screamed at one another, my two sisters and myself, we had to end the day on a joke, whether we liked it or not. And that had great ramifications for me. And the whole notion of fun being frivolous is now absolutely, totally discounted. It is a therapy. It is a positive outlook on life. And if Plato's in your corner, that's pretty good, along with Benny Hill and a few others.
Okay, Bob, I'm going to circle us back a little bit to sex, because after all, the first two in Love Lost, okay?
Yeah.
And I think that nowhere is humor more necessary than in the bedroom, because there's a lot of tension and pressure around sex today. And, rarely are partners in the same mood at the same time. So sometimes I'll suggest to my couple clients that if they're facing this, that they might have a chalkboard that they hang on the bedroom door. Now, if you have small children, you can't do this, but so you have a list of love-making moods, and they may vary from one, quick, recreational, aerobic, and then I want to go to sleep. Two, I'm not so interested, but I'll go along. Three, reverent and spiritual, a three-hour momentous event. So couples can then be in a more playful mood and have a little more fun with sex and maybe play out some fantasies and perhaps have a, maybe wear a clown nose. That might bring up some laughter as part of sexual props.
And don't do it at Denny's at 12 noon.
No. I'm talking in the bedroom.
You're right. The therapeutic aspect of fun in sex, as you well know, is the removal of inhibition.
Yes.
Booze of sex to free the person. But the question is, how do you remove those taboos? I don't know if you can remove the tattoos today. And God knows, 40 years from now, we're going to have just 80 million women, grandmothers, running around with tattoos all over their body, nose rings, and belly button slivers.
And they're going to look pretty weird with the wrinkled skin, I think.
Yeah. Back to sex and fun. Dr. Rubin came out many years ago with everything you wanted to know about sex, were afraid to ask. Everybody said, wow, we can finally talk about these taboos up in the open. I was a newsman at the time, and I was invited to go to a sex dysfunctional clinic. It wasn't called that because they realized, well, they did call it that. And when they told me, I said, the first thing you have to do is change the name of your clinic. You can't tell your wife, you can't tell friends, I'm going to a sexual dysfunction clinic.
No, you can't.
Right away, everybody at the YMCA knows you have premature ejaculation or whatever else. They changed the name to the Riverside Rainbow Clinic. All right? They were smart enough to know the name that you give a child, the name that you give a therapy is critically important to how people perceive it. So I was invited to go, and I would, there were 16 different couples. 15 of them signed a waiver that I and several other folks could be behind all doctors. I'm not a medical doctor, PhD type, but they agreed that we could be behind the two-way mirrors when they were going through these exercises. And I was watching. A bit of me was a voyeur. The other part was, the PhD writing the paper and the book.
Sure.
And the first thing we saw, the first exercise they had, they asked, and some were sex surrogates. Some men didn't bring their wives. They had the sex surrogate. They're mm-hmm. sitting on the bed, and they were told to sit on the bed in their underwear, not touch one another, and just to chat, all right? And we watched. Well, as you say, particularly the men. The men came in and they were scared stiff. That's the only part of them that was stiff, apparently, at that point, is their mental attitude.
Right.
Afraid that they were going to be exposed, that this lady here was a sex therapist. She knew everything you should and shouldn't do about sex, and I couldn't do any of this. And these guys just were in a state of fear. Now, what does fun do? It changes your perception of pain. And number two, here's the critical virtue that it has for sex therapists, for people who are running clinics like this, and for cancer wards. Fun removes fear. When you're laughing, you can't be afraid. And
that's
when
right.
you're laughing, that fear becomes a monster that is shrunken down to size that you control. We suggested to them the next day, do the same thing, and gave them a series of questions. And the people, the couples came in, they sat down on the bed in their underwear, and this time the sex therapist said, what's the funniest joke you've ever heard in your life? Right? Mm. That was the first question.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the men, my God, this is what a sex therapist is asking me? And he starts telling a joke, all right? And they're now laughing with one another. Then her second question was, what was your most embarrassing moment? Not necessarily in sex, but anything, all right? And they start talking about all the crazy things that all of us have in our life. And finally, we're looking, and after 6 minutes, this guy is laughing. But apart from that, what else is he doing? He's relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says, this is our next exercise. But if you don't want to do it, she says, that's fine. She says, we'll just, you know, tell more jokes. 10 out of 10 of them said, yeah, let's do the exercise. They got them into a position where they were laughing and created a personal human level. All humans have embarrassing moments. All humans have jokes. And they felt like they were just friends. And the sex wasn't going to work on people who already came in who were damaged if they were going to be uptight. So the therapeutic use of sex, of fun in the sex act, is to see it as play. You can't just do it on the one-night stands. You can't do it the way young people are doing it today. There's no romance to sex to them. It's all, hey, a booty call. Take it off. Let's get to it.
It's the hookup.
Yeah,
I find in my therapeutic sessions with couples that if we can laugh together, and usually it's not the first session because they're often very anxious, but we can begin to laugh together, it often makes everything go better. And I have a joke that I've told, oh, here and there to a couple, and it fits in very well to what we're talking about. And by the way, everybody knows this, but, you know, sex therapy is all talk therapy. I send them home with homework assignments, and they do it. So I tell this joke, and I'm going to tell it now. It's short, but it reveals something about attitudes and keeping a locked door
intercourse. What we're going to do qualify as phone sex, because I have to clear my Catholic conscience.
Yeah, okay. Clear your Catholic conscience.
Okay, hold on.
All right.
The old Hawaiian chant. Don Ho, King Kamehameha. I'm ready.
You're ready. Okay, so a dad is walking with his 5-year-old son in the park. It's a Sunday afternoon, and two little dogs are going at it. And the little boy says, Daddy, what are they doing? And the father says, Oh, well, son, you know, they're making a little puppy. So that satisfies the boy. And then a little bit later in the afternoon, they're home, and the little boy is supposed to be taking a nap, and mom and dad have decided to have a little matinee, a little sexual matinee. But they don't have a lock on their bedroom door, and the son walks in on them, and they're being sexual, and he stands at the foot of the bed, and he says, Daddy, what are you doing? And the father is absolutely shocked to see the boy there, but he clears his throat and says, oh, well, son, we're making you a little sister or maybe a little brother. And the boy says, oh, heck, Daddy, I'd much rather have a puppy. Turn her over. And that inevitably gets the couple to laugh. And sexuality can produce anxiety, especially when there are the dysfunctions, when there are the problems. So laughter is so very, very helpful.
You're kidding. There's nothing else you can name that's going to relax people, unless you declare right away that they're winners of the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes. More than fun, because we're talking about you cannot attack any problem if you're fearful. If you take your right hand right now and you clench your fist and you clench it as hard as you possibly can, in a state of fear, that's what happens to your internal organs.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens to your muscle structure. I'm sitting to you now, in case those people just dialed into you, I'm sitting in the physical therapy office, right? I just had 40 minutes of getting the back cracked and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the physical therapist just handed me a little note, and he said, you're about to be set on fire because I've been sitting, because of the bad back I have, on this heating pad, and it's now it's tinkling red lights all over the place. But the point is... No.
Want you to stay hot, but not too hot.
See what you did to me? I guess it is a kind of phone sex. You have to diminish the fear to attack the problem. And a very interesting thing, one of my more interesting interviews in the last 2 months, I interviewed a Navy SEAL. And this Navy SEAL was part of SEAL Team 6, of course, who made the big hit on Bin Laden. I'm not saying that they went in there and telling jokes to Bin Laden before they pulled the trigger. How's your wife? She's an angel. You're lucky. Mine's still alive. Bang, bang, bang. No, nothing like that at all. But I said to him, there's 16 guys, and you're being told you're going to be involved in the biggest operation for a group this size in the history of the planet. You're going to take out the world's number one terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
You got to tell me, when you were in that helicopter and on the way, even with all your training, you got to tell me that you guys had a high, high fear ratio. And he looked at me. And after an hour of talking with this fellow, he wasn't a BS artist. This man was the best of who we are as Americans. He knew what he had to do. He was doing it for his country. And he loved the men around him, and he loved the training he had. So he wasn't giving me a heroic John Wayne message. He said, Bob, he said, we had trained for 8 months for this. And in that training, he said, we had more fun because we were a close-knit group and we knew one another. And there's very few jobs in the world where you can't have a problem with the people you're working with. It's SEAL Team, whatever it is, 5, 4, or 6. You depend on that person for your life.
Yeah.
And he said, humor, and he said this. He said, in World War II, we produced more humor books. And he said, I just came from a reunion, and there were German soldiers and Japanese soldiers there, and they all stood up, and they were asked the question, what was the difference between Japan, Germany, and the American soldiers? Why did we win?
I bet I know the answer. Go ahead.
Well, you would expect them to say, well, you had a great industry. You could produce X amount of planes. And the German stood up, gentleman about 87 years of age, and this is what the SEAL Team 6 members telling me, and he said, you people could tell jokes.
Yeah.
In the middle of disaster, you were telling jokes, you were singing, bless them all, bless them all. He said, we didn't tell jokes in Germany when we're on the front lines. We didn't sing. The Japanese just looked and he says, well, all I can say is ditto, ditto, ditto. You know the Japanese culture. We were very serious about
very
what
serious.
We did.
Yeah.
And we were totally taken back, even when we were taken as prisoners. The Americans were always laughing. They were always telling jokes. Why? Because they were scared stiff like anyone else in combat. And laughter reduces that fear.
Yes, and can you expand, when we did a pre-interview, you just said John Wayne, which was a little bit a tidbit, because the question that I wanted to ask you was, give us an example of how fun and laughter made a dramatic change in your life, and then you said John Wayne, and I want more, and I know our listening audience wants more as well, Bob.
John Wayne gave me a career in Hollywood movies. Prior to that, I had done off-Broadway and Broadway shows, and I did national tours of Odd Couple and South Pacific and stuff like that. I'll make it quick. We have how many minutes? Tell me how many minutes we got.
We need to stop. We need to stop about two to three minutes before the top of the hour, so we've got maybe 4 minutes.
All right. I'll make it real quick. I was touring in a play, the Overammergau Passion play, The Last 2 Weeks in the Life of Christ. And I was playing, of course, Judas. My mother said, what else? What other character would you play? Selling Christ down the river three times a day, sometimes matinee. And we were performing, sponsored by the American Baptist Association. So they put us in humongous halls, 10, 12, 13,000 people. And I won't go into the specifics, but John Heal was a friend of mine. People may remember his name. He later became famous on Broadway as the Elephant Man. He played Pontius Pilate, and I played Judas, and I also played Longinus, the soldier who spears Christ in the side on the cross and then realizes, truly, this man is the Son of God. Well, we got into some problems because John and I, we used to cast people for the extras. And one of the people we cast was Salome, and usually it was a 16-year-old girl. This time we were in San Antonio, and we had cast, oh, how should I put this diplomatically, a 33-year-old prostitute, and that's a long story on how we even knew she was a prostitute, who had the superstructure of a battleship. And the man who was playing the Christ, Val Balfour, didn't know, because he didn't see the rehearsal, thinking when we're in Pontius Pilate's court and the people shout, whom shall I release unto you? And they shout, free Barabbas. It's very interesting. And side note, do you know why they said free Barabbas?
Cause no, I don't.
Barabbas' first name was Jesus, so he had to distinguish between Jesus Christ and Barabbas. Nevertheless, a little history aside. Out came this 33-year-old, 40-inch on the superstructure, former stripper and call girl, and she bumped and grinded, and the audience, half of them, of course they were Baptists now, half of them just got up and walked out, the other half yelling and screaming. Nevertheless, Pontius Pilate and me, Judas, were fired. We looked in the newspaper and we saw John Wayne making a movie in Brackettville, Texas, needs equestrian. I says, John, we're going to be equestrians. Then the next thing was, what's an equestrian? And he had to tell me, equestrian is someone who rides a horse. I'm from Brooklyn. The only horse I ever rode was on a merry-go-round. And it's all about John Wayne, my career. We go down to Brackettville, Texas. We stop at Big Bubba's. Big Bubba's is a cowboy outfitter. We got the big Bubba belt. We got the Bubba cowboy hat. We got the Bubba boots. But you cannot put all those things on a Brooklyn Italian and expect them to look like a cowboy. We go to Brackettville. And I'm going to make this real quick because I know you got to run.
We got to wrap it up. But, yes, it's a good story.
So,
it's a wonderful story.
We got on two horses. We were told we're going to have to do an audition. And they kicked the horses. John falls off. I lose the reins. And I continue past the point I was supposed to stop, and I go ass over backwards into a large fire. There were 3,000 Mexican folks as extras there at Santa Ana's Army. And I see, as I'm lying next to this fire, this big man coming towards me, and I'm looking, my God, it's John Wayne, my hero, and he's dressed as Davy Crockett. And he looks down at me. He says, who the hell do you think you are? And I looked up at him, and I said, I'm an equestrian, sir. And he said, if you're an equestrian, I'm the Queen of England. Get up here. What's the story? And I told him I'm an actor looking for a part. He gave me a part. defending the Alamo. He gave John a part, and I went on to be in three of John Wayne's movies. And there is a part to this where I halted the production because of another problem. You read the book, you'll see. And John Wayne would always send a Christmas card to my mother every year with a P.S. Remind that Brooklyn defender of the Alamo that he still owes me $30,000 for halting production on the assault of the Alamo. And that's another story we don't have time for.
Well, but and I hope that we'll have time, Bob, because I'm hoping you'll come back to this program maybe April 2nd or April 9th.
Yes, we'll talk about that off the air.
Absolutely.
You're
one of the best storytellers in the world, and I want people to know, and it'll be on the summary up on the website, they need to go to BobBasso.com. You can even see him in action speaking, because he does a lot of speaking. Bob, you have been just great and really fun and funny, and I thank you, Bob, for being such a wonderful guest today.
And I leave you with my mother's words to me. If you think you're so important, just remember, when you die, ultimately the size of your funeral will depend on the weather.
On the weather, exactly. That helps you with priorities and perspective. Perspective, yes. Thanks again, Bob.
You bet. Aloha no kau koka haka yaka.
Exactly. Aloha to you and to everybody else. And I'll be back next week with Candida Royale. And she's an erotic filmmaker, so a little change of pace. We'll do it. Bye, everybody.